Booth. I consider it lost. Well, then, I will buy it of you. You? Yes, I. But at a tremendous discount, of course. No. For 200,000 francs. Our house, added the Englishman with a laugh, does not do things in that way. And you will pay ready money. And the Englishman drew from his pocket a bundle of banknotes, which might have been twice the sum Monsieur de Beauville feared to lose. A ray of joy passed across Monsieur de Beauville's countenance, yet he made an effort over himself and said, "Sir, I ought to tell you that in all probability you will not have 6% of this sum." "That's no affair of mine," replied the Englishman. "That is the affair of the House of Thompson and French, in whose name I act. They have, perhaps, some motive to serve in hastening the ruin of a rival firm. But all I know, sir, is that I am ready to hand you over this sum in exchange for your assignment of the debt. I only ask a brokerage." "Of course, that is perfectly just," cried Monsieur de Beauville. The commission is usually 1.5. Will you have 2, 3, 5%, or even more? Say, sir," replied the Englishman, laughing, "I am like my house and do not do such things. No, the commission I ask is quite different. Name it, sir, I beg. You are the inspector of prisons? I have been so these 14 years. You keep the registers of entries and departures? I do. To these registers there are added notes relative to the prisoners. There are special reports on every prisoner. Well, sir, I was educated at Rome by a poor devil of an abbé who disappeared suddenly. I have since learned that he was confined in the Chateau d'If, and I should like to learn some particulars of his death."
"What was his name?"
"The Abbé Faria."
"Oh, I recollect him perfectly," cried Monsieur de Beauville. "He was crazy."
"So they said."
"Oh, he was, decidedly.
Very possibly. But what sort of madness was it?"
"He pretended to know of an immense treasure, and offered vast sums to government if they would liberate him."
"Poor devil. And he is dead?"
"Yes, sir. 5 or 6 months ago, last February."
"You have a good memory, sir, to recollect dates so well."
"I recollect this, because the poor devil's death was accompanied by a singular circumstance."
"May I ask what that was?" said the Englishman, with an expression of curiosity which a close observer would have been astonished at discovering in his phlegmatic countenance.
"Oh, dear, yes, sir. The abbé's dungeon was 40 or 50 feet distant from that of an old agent of Bonaparte's, one of those who had the most contributed to the return of the usurper in 1815, a very resolute and very dangerous man."
"Indeed," said the Englishman.
"Yes," replied Monsieur de Beauville. "I myself had occasion to see this man in 1816 or 1817, and we could only go into his dungeon with a file of soldiers. That man made a deep impression on me. I shall never forget his countenance."
The Englishman smiled imperceptibly. "And you say, sir," he said, "that the two dungeons were separated by a distance of 50 feet. But it appears that this Edmond Dantès, this dangerous man's name was Edmond Dantès. It appears, sir, that this Edmond Dantès had procured tools, or made them, for they found a passage by which the prisoners communicated. This passage was formed, no doubt, with an intention of escape.
No doubt. But unfortunately for the prisoners, the Abbé Faria had an attack of catalepsy and died.
That must have cut short the projects of escape."
"For the dead man, yes," replied Monsieur de Beauville, "but not for the survivor. On the contrary, this Dantès saw a means of accelerating his escape." He no doubt thought that prisoners who died in the Chateau d'If were interred in a burial ground as usual, and he conveyed the dead man into his own cell, assumed his place in the sack in which they had sewed up the defunct, and awaited the moment of interment. It was a bold step, and one that indicated some courage, remarked the Englishman. As I have already told you, sir, he was a very dangerous man, and fortunately, by his own act, disembarrassed the government of the fears it had on his account.
How was that?
How? Do you not comprehend?
No.
The Chateau d'If has no cemetery, and they simply throw the dead into the sea, after having fastened a 36-pound bullet to their feet.
Well, observed the Englishman, as if he were slow of comprehension.
Well, they fastened a 36-pound bullet to his feet and threw him into the sea.
Really?
Exclaimed the Englishman.
Yes, sir, continued the inspector of prisons. You may imagine the amazement of the fugitive when he found himself flung headlong beneath the rocks. I should like to have seen his face at that moment.
That would have been difficult.
No matter, replied de Beauvais, in supreme good humour at the certainty of recovering his 200,000 francs. No matter, I can fancy it. And he shouted with laughter.
So can I, said the Englishman, and he laughed too, but he laughed as the English do, at the end of his teeth.
And so, continued the Englishman, who first regained his composure, he was drowned,
unquestionably,
so that the governor got rid of the fierce and crazy prisoner at the same time.
Precisely.
But some official document was drawn up as to this affair, I suppose, inquired the Englishman.
Yes, yes, the mortuary deposition. You understand, Dante's relations, if he had any, might have some interest in knowing if he were dead or alive.
So that now, if there were anything to inherit from him, they may do so with easy conscience. He is dead, and no mistake about it.
Oh, yes, and they may have the fact attested whenever they please.
So be it, said the Englishman. But to return to these registers.
True, this story has diverted our attention from them. Excuse me.
Excuse you for what?
For the story, by no means. It really seems to me very curious.
Yes, indeed. So, sir, you wish to see all relating to the poor abbé, who really was gentleness itself.
Yes, you will much oblige me. Go into my study here, and I will show it to you.
And they both entered Monsieur de Beauvais' study. All was here arranged in perfect order. Each register had its number, each file of paper its place. The inspector begged the Englishman to seat himself in an armchair and placed before him the register and documents relative to the Chateau d'If, giving him all the time he desired to examine it, whilst de Beauvais seated himself in a corner and began to read his newspaper. The Englishman easily found the entries relative to the Abbé Faria, but it seemed that the history which the inspector had related interested him greatly, for after having perused the first documents, he turned over the leaves until he reached the deposition respecting Edmond Dantès. There he found everything arranged in due order. The denunciation, examination, Morel's petition, Monsieur de Villefort's marginal notes. He folded up the denunciation quietly and put it as quietly in his pocket. Read the examination and saw that the name of Noirtier was not mentioned in it. Perused, too, the application dated 10th April 1815, in which Morel, by the deputy procureur's advice, exaggerated with the best intentions, for Napoleon was then on the throne, the services Dantès had rendered to the imperial cause, services which Villefort's certificates rendered indispensable. Then he saw through all. This petition to Napoleon, kept back by Villefort, had become, under the Second Restoration, a terrible weapon against him in the hands of the Procureur du Roi. He was no longer astonished when he searched on to find in the register this note placed in a bracket against his name. Edmond Dantès, an inveterate Bonapartist, took an active part in the return from the Isle of Elba, to be kept in complete solitary confinement and to be strictly watched and guarded. Beneath these lines was written, in another hand, "See note above, nothing can be done." He compared the writing in the bracket with the writing of the certificate placed beneath Morel's petition, and discovered that the note in the bracket was the same writing as the certificate, that is to say, were in Villefort's handwriting. As to the note which accompanied this, the Englishman understood that it might have been added by some inspector who had taken a momentary interest in Dante's situation, but who had, from the remarks we have quoted, found it impossible to give any effect to the interest he experienced. As we have said, the inspector, from discretion, and that he might not disturb the Abbé Faria's pupil in his researches, had seated himself in a corner and was reading Le Drapeau Blanc. He did not see the Englishman fold up and place in his pocket the denunciation written by Danglars under the arbor of La Réserve, and which had the postmark of Marseille, 2nd March, delivery, 6 o'clock p.m. But it must be said that if he had seen it, he attached so small importance to this scrap of paper, and so great importance to his 200,000 francs, that he would not have opposed what the Englishman did, how incorrect soever it might be. "Thanks," said the latter, closing the register with a noise. "I have all I want. Now it is for me to perform my promise. Give me a simple assignment of your debt, acknowledge therein the receipt of the cash, and I will hand you over the money." He rose, gave his seat to Monsieur de Beauville, who took it without ceremony, quickly drew out the required assignment, whilst the Englishman was counting out the banknotes on the other side of the desk.
29. The House of Morel and Son. Anyone who had quitted Marseille a few years previously, well acquainted with the interior of Morel's house, and had returned at this date, would have found a great change. Instead of that air of life, of comfort, and of happiness that exhales from a flourishing and prosperous house, instead of the merry faces seen at the windows, of the busy clerks hurrying to and fro in the long corridors, instead of the court filled with bales of goods, re-echoing the cries and the jokes of the porters, he would have at once perceived an air of sadness and gloom. In the deserted corridors and the empty office, out of all the numerous clerks that used to fill the office, but two remained. One was a young man of 23 or 24, who was in love with Monsieur Morel's daughter, and had remained with him spite of the efforts of his friends to induce him to withdraw. The other was an old one-eyed cashier named Cocles, a nickname given him by the young men who used to inhabit this vast beehive, now almost deserted, and which had so completely replaced his real name that he would not, in all probability, have replied to anyone who addressed himself by it. Cocles remained in Monsieur Morel's service, and a most singular change had taken place in his situation. He had, at the same time, risen to the rank of cashier, and sunk to the rank of a servant. He was, however, the same Cocles, good, patient, devoted, but inflexible on the subject of arithmetic, the only point on which he would have stood firm against the world, even against Monsieur Morel, and strong in the multiplication table, which he had at his fingers' ends, no matter what scheme or what trap was laid to catch him. In the midst of the distress of the house, Cocles was the only one unmoved. Cocles had seen all these numerous clerks go without thinking of inquiring the cause of their departure. Everything was, as we have said, a question of arithmetic to Cocles, and during 20 years he had always seen all payments made with such exactitude that it seemed as impossible to him that the house should stop payment as it would to a miller that the river that so long turned his mill should cease to flow. Nothing had as yet occurred to shake Cocles' belief. The last month's payment had been made with the most scrupulous exactitude. Cocles had detected an error of 14 sous to the prejudice of Morel, and the same evening he had brought them to Monsieur Morel, who, with a melancholy smile, threw them into an almost empty drawer, saying, "Thanks, Cocles, you are the pearl of cashiers." Cocles retired perfectly happy, for this eulogium of Monsieur Morel, himself the pearl of the honest men of Marseille, flattered him more than a present of £50. But since the end of the month, Monsieur Morel had passed many an anxious hour. In order to meet the end of the month, he had collected all his resources, and fearing lest the report of his distress should get bruited abroad at Marseille when he was known to be reduced to such an extremity, he went to the fair of Beaucaire to sell his wife and daughter's jewels and a portion of his plate. By this means, the end of the month was past, but his resources were now exhausted. Credit, owing to the reports afloat, was no longer to be had, and to meet the £4,000 due on the 15th of the present month to Monsieur de Beauville, and the £4,000 due on the 15th of the next month, Monsieur Morel had, in reality, no hope but the return of the Pharaon, whose departure he had learnt from a vessel which had weighed anchor at the same time, and which had already arrived in harbour. But this vessel, which, like the Pharaon, came from Calcutta, had arrived a fortnight, whilst no intelligence had been received of the Pharaon. Such was the state of things when, the day after his interview with Monsieur de Beauville, the confidential clerk of the House of Thompson and French of Rome presented himself at Monsieur Morel's. Emmanuel received him. Every fresh face alarmed the young man, for every fresh face meant a fresh creditor coming in his uncertainty to consult the head of the firm. The young man, wishing to spare his employer the pain of this interview, questioned the newcomer, but the stranger declared he had nothing to say to Monsieur Emmanuel, and that his business was with Monsieur Morel in person. Emmanuel sighed and summoned Cocles. Cocles appeared, and the young man bade him conduct the stranger to Monsieur Morel's apartment. Cocles went first, and the stranger followed him. On the staircase they met a beautiful girl of 16 or 17, who looked with anxiety at the stranger.
"Monsieur Morel is in his room, is he not, Mademoiselle Julie?" said the cashier.
"Yes,
I think so, at least," said the young girl hesitatingly. "Go and see, Cocles, and if my father is there, announce this gentleman."
"It will be useless to announce me, mademoiselle," returned the Englishman. "Monsieur Morel does not know my name. This worthy gentleman has only to announce the confidential clerk of the House of Thompson and French of Rome, with whom your father does business."
The young girl turned pale and continued to descend, whilst the stranger and Cocles continued to mount the staircase. She entered the office where Emmanuel was, whilst Cocles, by the aid of a key he possessed, opened a door in the corner of a landing-place on the second staircase, conducted the stranger into an antechamber, opened a second door which he closed behind him, and after having left the clerk of the House of Thompson and French alone, returned and signed to him that he could enter. The Englishman entered and found Morel seated at a table, turning over the formidable columns of his ledger, which contained the list of his liabilities. At the sight of the stranger, Monsieur Morel closed the ledger, rose and offered a seat to the stranger, and when he had seen him seated, resumed his own chair. 14 years had changed the worthy merchant, who, in his 36th year at the opening of this history, was now in his 50th. His hair had turned white, time and sorrow had ploughed deep furrows on his brow, and his look, once so firm and penetrating, was now irresolute and wandering, as if he feared being forced to fix his attention on an idea or a man. The Englishman looked at him with an air of curiosity, evidently mingled with interest.
"Monsieur," said Morel, whose uneasiness was increased by this examination, "you wish to speak to me?"
"Yes, monsieur. You are aware from whom I come?"
"The House of Thompson and French. At least, so my cashier tells me. He has told you rightly. The House of Thompson and French has 300,000 or 400,000 francs, 12,000 to 16,000 pounds, to pay this month in France, and knowing your strict punctuality, have collected all the bills bearing your signature, and charged me, as they became due, to present them, and to employ the money otherwise."
Morel sighed deeply and passed his hand over his forehead, which was covered with perspiration.
"So then, sir," said Morel, "you hold bills of mine?"
"Yes,
and for a considerable sum."
"What is the amount?" asked Morel, with a voice he strove to render firm. "Here is," said the Englishman, taking a quantity of papers from his pocket, "an assignment of 200,000 francs to our house by Monsieur de Beauville, the inspector of prisons, to whom they are due. You acknowledge, of course, you owe this sum to him?"
"Yes."
"He placed the money in my hands at 4.5% nearly 5 years ago. When are you to pay?
Half the 15th of this month, half the 15th of next."
"Just so. And now, here are 32,000 francs payable shortly. They are all signed by you and assigned to our house by the holders."
"I recognize them," said Morel, whose face was suffused as he thought that, for the first time in his life, he would be unable to honor his own signature.
"Is this all?"
"No.
I have, for the end of the month, these bills which have been assigned to us by the House of Pascal and the House of Wild and Turner of Marseille, amounting to nearly 55,000 francs, £2,200. In all, 287,500 francs, £11,500.
It is impossible to describe what Morel suffered during this enumeration.
287,500 francs, repeated he.
"Yes, sir," replied the Englishman.
"I will not," continued he, after a moment's silence, "conceal from you that whilst your probity and exactitude up to this moment are universally acknowledged, yet the report is current in Marseille that you are not able to meet your engagements." At this almost brutal speech, Morel turned deathly pale.
"Sir," said he, "up to this time, and it is now more than 24 years since I received the direction of this house from my father, who had himself conducted it for 35 years, never has anything bearing the signature of Morel and Son been dishonored."
"I know that," replied the Englishman. "But, as a man of honor should answer another, tell me fairly, shall you pay these with the same punctuality?"
Morel shuddered and looked at the man, who spoke with more assurance than he had hitherto shown.
"To questions frankly put," said he, "a straightforward answer should be given. Yes, I shall pay if, as I hope, my vessel arrives safely, for its arrival will again procure me the credit which the numerous accidents of which I have been the victim have deprived me. But if the Pharaon should be lost, and this last resource be gone..." The poor man's eyes filled with tears.
"Well," said the other,
"if this last resource fail you?"
"Well," returned Morel, "it is a cruel thing to be forced to say, but, already used to misfortune, I must habituate myself to shame. I fear I shall be forced to suspend my payments."
"Have you no friends who could assist you?"
Morel smiled mournfully.
"In business, sir," said he, "one has no friends, only correspondents."
"It is true," murmured the Englishman.
"Then you have but one hope?"
"But one."
"The last?"
"The last.
So that if this fail, I am ruined, completely ruined.
As I came here, a vessel was entering the port."
"I know it, sir. A young man who still adheres to my fallen fortunes passes a part of his time in a belvedere at the top of the house in hopes of being the first to announce good news to me. He has informed me of the entrance of this ship."
"And it is not yours?"
"No. It is a vessel of Bordeaux La Gironde. It comes from India also, but it is not mine. Perhaps it has spoken the Pharaon and brings you some tidings of it. Shall I tell you plainly one thing, sir? I dread almost as much to receive any tidings of my vessel as to remain in doubt. Incertitude is still hope."
Then, in a low voice, Morel added,
"This delay is not natural. The Pharaon left Calcutta the 5th of February. It ought to have been here a month ago."
"What is that?" said the Englishman. "What is the meaning of this noise?
"Oh, oh," cried Morel, turning pale. "What is this?"
A loud noise was heard on the stairs of people moving hastily and half-stifled sobs. Morel rose and advanced to the door, but his strength failed him and he sank into a chair. The two men remained opposite one another, Morel trembling in every limb, the stranger gazing at him with an air of profound pity. The noise had ceased, but it seemed that Morel expected something. Something had occasioned the noise, and something must follow. The stranger fancied he heard footsteps on the stairs, and that the steps, which were of those several persons, stopped at the door. A key was inserted in the lock of the first door, and the creaking of hinges was audible.
"There are only two persons who have the key of the door," murmured Morel. "Cocles and Julie."
At this instant the second door opened, and the young girl, her eyes bathed with tears, appeared. Morel rose tremblingly, supporting himself by the arm of the chair. He would have spoken, but his voice failed him.
"Oh, father," said she, clasping her hands, "forgive your child for being the messenger of ill."
Morel again changed colour. Julie threw herself into his arms.
"Oh, father, father," murmured she, "courage."
"The Ferron has then perished," said Morel, in a hoarse voice.
The young girl did not speak, but she made an affirmative sign with her head as she lay on her father's breast.
"And the crew?"
asked Morel.
"Saved," said the girl, "saved by the crew of the vessel that has just entered the harbour."
Morel raised his two hands to heaven with an expression of resignation and sublime gratitude.
"Thanks, my God," said he. "At least you strike but me alone."
Spite of his phlegm, a tear moistened the eye of the Englishman.
"Come in, come in," said Morel, "for I presume you are all at the door."
Scarcely had he uttered these words than Madame Morel entered, weeping bitterly. Emmanuel followed her, and in the antechamber were visible the rough faces of seven or eight half-naked sailors. At the sight of these men the Englishman started and advanced a step, then restrained himself and retired into the farthest and most obscure corner of the apartment. Madame Morel sat down by her husband and took one of his hands in hers. Julie still lay with her head on his shoulder. Emmanuel stood in the centre of the chamber and seemed to form the link between Morel's family and the sailors at the door.
"How did this happen?" said Morel.
"Draw nearer, Penelon," said the young man, "and relate all." An old seaman, bronzed by the tropical sun, advanced, twirling the remains of a hat between his hands.
"Good day, Monsieur Morel," said he, as if he had just quitted Marseille the previous evening and had just returned from Aix to Toulon.
"Good day, Penelon,"
returned Morel, who could not refrain from smiling through his tears.
"Where is the captain?"
"The captain, Monsieur Morel. He has stayed behind sick at Parma. But please God it won't be much, and you will see him in a few days all alive and hearty.
Well, now tell your story, Penelon."
Penelon rolled his quid in his cheek, placed his hand before his mouth, turned his head, and sent a long jet of tobacco juice into the antechamber, advanced his foot, and began.
"You see, Monsieur Morel," said he, "we were somewhere between Cape Blanc and Cape Bogador, sailing with a fair breeze south-southwest after a week's calm, when Captain Gomard comes up to me, I was at the helm, I should tell you, and says, 'Penelon, what do you think of those clouds that are arising there?' I was just then looking at them myself. 'What do I think, Captain?' 'Why, I think that they are rising faster than they have any business, and that they would not be so black if they did not mean mischief.' 'That's my opinion, too,' said the Captain, 'and I'll take precautions accordingly. We are carrying too much canvas. Hallo, all hands to slacken sail and lower the flying jib.' It was time. The squall was on us, and the vessel began to heel. 'Ah,' said the captain, 'we have still too much canvas set. All hands to lower the mainsail.' 5 minutes after, it was down, and we sailed under mizzen topsails and t'gallant sails. 'Well, Penelon,' said the captain, 'what makes you shake your head?' 'Why,' I says, 'I don't think that we shall stop here.' 'I think you are right,' answered he. 'We shall have a gale.' 'A gale? More than that, we shall have a tempest, or I know nothing about it.' You could see the wind coming like the dust at Montredon. Luckily, the captain understood his business. "All hands take in two reefs in the topsails," cried the captain. "Let go the bowlines. Brace to. Lower the topgallant sails. Haul out the reef tackles on the yards."
"That was not enough for those latitudes," said the Englishman. "I should have taken four reefs in the topsails and lowered the mizzen."
His firm, sonorous, and unexpected voice made everyone start. Penelon put his hand over his eyes and then stared at the man who thus criticized the manoeuvres of his captain.
"We did better than that, sir," said the old sailor with a certain respect. "We put the helm to the wind to run before the tempest. 10 minutes after, we struck our topsails and scudded under bare poles."
"The vessel was very old to risk that," said the Englishman.
It was that wrecked us. After having been tossed about for 12 hours, we sprung a leak."
"Penelon," said the captain, "I think we are sinking. Give me the helm and go down into the hold."
I gave him the helm and descended. There was already 3 feet of water. I cried, "All hands to the pumps," but it was too late, and it seemed the more we pumped, the more came in.
"Ah," said I, after 4 hours' work, "since we are sinking, let us sink. We can die but once."
"That's the example you set, Penelon," cries the captain.
"Very well, wait a minute." He went into his cabin and came back with a brace of pistols. "I will blow the brains out of the first man who leaves the pump," said he.
"Well done," said the Englishman. "There's nothing gives you so much courage as good reasons," continued the sailor, "and during that time the wind had abated and the sea gone down, but the water kept rising. Not much, only 2 inches an hour, but still it rose. 2 inches an hour does not seem much, but in 12 hours that makes 2 feet, and 3 we had before, that makes 5.
"Come," said the captain, "we have done all in our power, and Monsieur Morel will have nothing to reproach us with. We have tried to save the ship. Let us now save ourselves. To the boats, my lads, as quick as you can."
"Now," continued Penelon, "you see, Monsieur Morel, a sailor is attached to his ship, but still more to his life, so we did not wait to be told twice, the more so that the ship was sinking under us and seemed to say, 'Get along, save yourselves.' We soon launched the boat, and all 8 of us got into it. The captain descended the last, or rather, he did not descend. He would not quit the vessel. So I took him round the waist and threw him into the boat, and then I jumped after him. It was time, for just as I jumped, the deck burst with a noise like the broadside of a man of war. 10 minutes after, she pitched forward, then the other way, spun round and round, and then, goodbye to the Fairon. As for us, we were 3 days without anything to eat or drink, so that we began to think of drawing lots who should feed the rest, when we saw La Gironde. We made signals of distress. She perceived us, made for us, and took us all on board. There now, Monsieur Morel, that's the whole truth, on the honour of a sailor. Is not it true, you fellows there?"
A general murmur of approbation showed that the narrator had faithfully detailed their misfortunes and sufferings.
"Well, well," said Morel, "I know there was no one in fault but destiny. It was the will of God that this should happen, blessed be his name. What wages are due to you?
Oh, don't let us talk of that, Monsieur Morel. On the contrary, let us speak of it."
"Well, then, 3 months," said Penelon.
"Cochlez, pay 200 francs to each of these good fellows," said Morel.
"At another time," added he, "I should have said give them besides 200 francs over as a present. But times are changed, and the little money that remains to me is not my own."
Penelon turned to his companions and exchanged a few words with them.
"As for that, Monsieur Morel," said he, again turning his quid, "as for that..."
"As for what?"
"The money."
"Well?"
"Well, we all say that 50 francs will be enough for us at present, and that we will wait for the rest."
"Thanks, my friends, thanks," cried Morel, gratefully. "Take it. Take it, and if you can find another employer, enter his service. You are free to do so."
These last words produced a prodigious effect on the seaman. Penelon nearly swallowed his quid. Fortunately, he recovered.
"What? Monsieur Morel?" said he, in a low voice. "You send us away? You are then angry with us?"
"No, no," said Monsieur Morel. "I am not angry. On the contrary, I do not send you away. But I have no more ships, and therefore I do not want any sailors."
"No more ships?" returned Penelon.
"Well, then, you build some. We'll wait for you. I have no money to build ships with, Penelon," said the poor owner mournfully, "so I cannot accept your kind offer."
"No more money?
Then you must not pay us. We can go like the Pharaoh, under bare poles. Enough! Enough!" cried Morel, almost overpowered. "Leave me, I pray you. We shall meet again in a happier time. Emmanuel, accompany them, and see that my orders are executed. At least, we shall see each other again, Monsieur Morel?" asked Penelon.
"Yes, I hope so, at least.
Now go." He made a sign to Cocles, who marched first. The seaman followed him, and Emmanuel brought up the rear.
"Now," said the owner to his wife and daughter, "leave me. I wish to speak with this gentleman."
And he glanced towards the clerk of Thompson and French, who had remained motionless in the corner during this scene, in which he had taken no part, except the few words we have mentioned. The two females looked at this person, whose presence they had entirely forgotten, and retired. But as she left the apartment, Julie gave the stranger a supplicating glance, to which he replied by a smile that an indifferent spectator would have been surprised to see on his stern features. The two men were left alone.
"Well, sir," said Morel, sinking into a chair, "you have heard all, and I have nothing further to tell you."
"I see," returned the Englishman, "that a fresh and unmerited misfortune has overwhelmed you, and this only increases my desire to serve you."
"Oh, sir," cried Morel. "Let me see," continued the stranger. "I am one of your largest creditors. Your bills, at least, are the first that will fall due. Do you wish for time to pay? A delay would save my honour, and consequently my life."
"How long a delay do you wish for?" Morel reflected.
2 months," said he.
"I will give you 3," replied the stranger.
"But," asked Morel, "will the house of Thompson and French consent?"
"Oh, I take everything on myself. Today is the 5th of June."
"Yes. Well, renew these bills up to the 5th of September, and on the 5th of September at 11 o'clock," the hand of the clock pointed to 11, "I shall come to receive the money."
"I shall expect you," returned Morel, "and I will pay you. Or I shall be dead." These last words were uttered in so low a tone that the stranger could not hear them. The bills were renewed, the old ones destroyed, and the poor shipowner found himself with 3 months before him to collect his resources. The Englishman received his thanks with the phlegm peculiar to his nation, and Morel, overwhelming him with grateful blessings, conducted him to the staircase. The stranger met Julie on the stairs. She affected to be descending, but in reality she was waiting for him.
"Oh, sir," said she, clasping her hands.
"Mademoiselle," said the stranger, "one day you will receive a letter signed Sinbad the Sailor. Do exactly what the letter bids you, however strange it may appear."
"Yes, sir," returned Julie.
"Do you promise?"
"I swear to you I will."
"It is well. Adieu, mademoiselle. Remain as pure and virtuous as you are at present, and I have great hopes that heaven will reward you by giving you Emmanuel for a husband." Julie uttered a faint cry, blushed like a rose, and leaned against the baluster. The stranger waved his hand and continued to descend. In the court he found Penelon, who, with a rouleau of 100 francs in either hand, seemed unable to make up his mind to retain them.
"Come with me, my friend," said the Englishman. "I wish to speak to you."
30. The 5th of September. The delay afforded by the agent of the House of Thompson and French, at the moment when Morel expected it least, appeared to the poor shipowner one of those returns of good fortune which announce to a man that fate is at length weary of wasting her spite upon him. The same day he related to his wife, to Emmanuel, and his daughter what had occurred to him, and a ray of hope, if not tranquillity, returned to the family. Unfortunately, however, Morel had not only engagements with the House of Thompson and French, who had shown themselves so considerate towards him, and, as he had said, in business he had correspondents and not friends. When he reflected deeply, he could by no means account for this generous conduct on the part of Thompson and French towards him, and could only attribute it to the selfish reflection of the firm. We had better support a man who owes us nearly 300,000 francs, and have that 300,000 francs at the end of 3 months, than hasten his ruin and have 6 or 8% of capital. Unfortunately, whether from hate or blindness, all Morel's correspondents did not reflect similarly, and some made even a contrary reflection. The bills signed by Morel were thus presented at his office with scrupulous exactitude, and, thanks to the delay granted by the Englishman, were paid by Cocklus with equal punctuality. Cocklus thus remained in his accustomed tranquillity. It was Morel alone who remembered with alarm that if he had to repay on the 15th the 100,000 francs of Monsieur de Beauville, and on the 30th the 32,500 francs of bills, for which, as well as the debt due to the inspector of prisons, he had time granted, he must be a ruined man. The opinion of all the commercial men was that, under the reverses which had successively weighed down Morel, it was impossible for him to stand against it. Great, therefore, was the astonishment when they saw the end of the month come, and he fulfilled all his engagements with his usual punctuality. Still, confidence was not restored to all minds, and the general voice postponed only until the end of the month the complete ruin of the unfortunate shipowner. The month passed amidst unheard-of efforts on the part of Morel to get in all his resources. Formerly, his paper at any date was taken with confidence and was even in request. Morel now tried to negotiate bills at 90 days only, and found all the banks closed. Fortunately, Morel had some monies coming in on which he could rely, and as they reached him he found himself in a condition to meet his engagements when the end of July came. The agent of Thompson of French had not been again seen at Marseille. The day after, or 2 days after his visit to Morel, he had disappeared, and as in that city he had had no intercourse but with the mayor, the inspector of prisons, and Monsieur Morel, his appearance left no other trace than the different remembrances of him which these three persons retained. As to the sailors of the Pharaon, it seemed that they must have found some engagement, for they had disappeared also. Captain Gomard, recovered from his illness, had returned from Palma. He hesitated to present himself at Morel's, but the owner, hearing of his arrival, went to him. The worthy shipowner knew from Penelon's recital of the captain's brave conduct during the storm, and tried to console him. He brought him also the amount of his wages, which Captain Gomard had not dared to apply for. As he descended the staircase, Morel met Penelon, who was going up. Penelon had, it would seem, made good use of his money, for he was newly clad. When he saw his employer, the worthy tar seemed much embarrassed, drew on one side into the corner of the landing-place, passed his quid from one cheek to the other, stared stupidly with his great eyes, and only acknowledged the squeeze of the hand which Morel, as usual, gave him by a slight pressure in return. Morel attributed Penelon's embarrassment to the elegance of his attire. It was evident the good fellow had not gone to such an expense on his own account. He was no doubt engaged on board some other vessel, and thus his bashfulness arose from the fact of his not having, if we may so express ourselves, worn mourning for the Pharaon longer. Perhaps he had come to tell Captain Gomard of his good luck, and to offer him employment from his new master. "Worthy fellow," said Morel as he went away,
May your new master love you as I loved you, and be more fortunate than I have been."
August rode by in unceasing efforts on the part of Morel to renew his credit or revive the old. On the 20th of August it was known at Marseille that he had taken a place in the mail coach, and then it was said that it was at the end of the month the docket was to be struck, and Morel had gone away before, that he might not be present at this cruel act, but had left his chief clerk, Emmanuel, and his cashier, Cocles, to meet it. But, contrary to all expectation, when the 31st of August came, the house opened as usual, and Cocles appeared behind the grating of the counter, examined all bills presented with the same scrutiny, and, from first to last, paid all with the same precision. There came in, moreover, two repayments which Monsieur Morel had anticipated, and which Cocles paid as punctually as those bills which the shipowner had accepted. All this was incomprehensible, and then, with the tenacity peculiar to prophets of bad news, the failure was put off until the end of September. On the 1st, Morel returned. He was awaited by his family with extreme anxiety, for from this journey to Paris they hoped a last means of safety would arrive. Morel had thought of Danglars, who was now immensely rich, and had lain under great obligations to Morel in former days, since to him it was owing that Danglars entered the service of the Spanish banker with whom had commenced his vast wealth. It was said at this moment that Danglars was worth from £200,000 to £300,000, and had unlimited credit. Danglars then, without taking a crown from his pocket, could save Morel. He had but to pass his word for a loan, and Morel was saved. Morel had long thought of Danglars, but there are those instinctive revoltings impossible to control, and Morel had delayed as long as possible before he had recourse to this last resource. And Morel was right, for he returned home, borne down by all the humiliation of a refusal. Yet, on his arrival, Morel did not utter a complaint, nor say one harsh word. He embraced his weeping wife and daughter, pressed Emmanuel's hand with friendly warmth, and then, going to his private room on the second floor, had sent for Cocles. "Then," said the two females to Emmanuel, "we are indeed ruined." It was agreed in a brief council held amongst them that Julie should write to her brother, who was in garrison at Nîmes, to come to them as speedily as possible. The poor woman felt instinctively that they required all their strength to support the blow that impended. Besides, Maximilian Morel, though hardly 22, had great influence over his father. He was a strong-minded, upright young man. At the time when he decided on his profession, his father had no desire to choose for him, but had consulted young Maximilian's taste. He had at once declared for a military life, and had, in consequence, studied hard, passed brilliantly through the École Polytechnique, and left it as sub-lieutenant of the 53rd of the line. For a year he had held this rank, and expected promotion on the first vacancy. In his regiment, Maximilian Morel was noted as the most rigid observer, not only of the obligations imposed on a soldier, but also of the duties of a man, and he thus gained the name of the Stoic. We need hardly say that many of those who gave him this epithet repeated it because they had heard it and did not even know what it meant. This was the young man whom his mother and sister called to their aid to sustain them under the grave circumstances which they felt they would soon have to endure. They had not mistaken the gravity of this event, for the moment after Morel had entered his cabinet with Cocles, Julie saw the latter leave it pale, trembling, and his features betraying the utmost consternation. She would have questioned him as he passed by her, but the worthy creature hastened down the staircase with unusual precipitation, and only raised his hands to heaven and exclaimed, "Oh, mademoiselle, mademoiselle, what a dreadful misfortune! Who could ever have believed it?" A moment afterwards, Julie saw him go upstairs carrying two or three heavy ledgers, a pocketbook, and a bag of money. Morel examined the ledgers, opened the pocketbook, and counted the money.
All his funds amounted to 6,000 or 8,000 francs, his expectancies up to the fifth to 4,000 or 5,000, which, making the best of everything, gave him 14,000 francs to meet bills amounting to 287,500 francs. He could not make such a proposal. However, when Morel went down to his dinner, he appeared very composed. This calmness was more alarming to the two women than the deepest dejection would have been. After dinner, Morel usually went out and used to take his coffee at the club of the Phocéens and read the Semaphore, but this day he did not leave the house but returned to his office. As to Cocles, he seemed completely bewildered. For part of the day he went into the courtyard, seated himself on a stone with his head bare and exposed to a sun of 30 degrees. Emmanuel tried to comfort the females, but his eloquence faltered. The young man was too well acquainted with the business of the house not to feel that a great catastrophe hung over the Morel family. Night came. The two women had watched, hoping that when he left his room, Morel would come to them, but they heard him pass before their door and trying to conceal the noise of his footsteps. They listened. He went into his sleeping room and fastened the door inside. Madame Morel sent her daughter to bed, and half an hour after Julie had retired, she rose, took off her shoes, and went stealthily along the passage to see through the keyhole what her husband was doing. In the passage, she saw a retreating shadow. It was Julie, who, uneasy herself, had anticipated her mother. The young lady went towards Madame Morel. "He is writing," she said. They had understood each other without speaking. Madame Morel looked again through the keyhole. Morel was writing. But Madame Morel remarked what her daughter had not observed, that her husband was writing on stamped paper. The terrible idea that he was writing his will flashed across her. She shuddered, and yet had not strength to utter a word. Next day, Monsieur Morel seemed as calm as ever, went into his office as usual, came to his breakfast punctually, and then, after dinner, he placed his daughter beside him, took her head in his arms, and held her for a long time against his bosom. In the evening, Julie told her mother that, although so calm in appearance, she had remarked that her father's heart beat violently. The next 2 days passed almost similarly. On the evening of the 4th of September, Monsieur Morel asked his daughter for the key of his cabinet. Julie trembled at this request, which seemed to her of bad omen. Why did her father ask for this key which she always kept, and which was only taken from her in childhood as a punishment? The young girl looked at Morel. "What have I done wrong, father," she said, "that you should take this key from me?" "Nothing, my dear," replied the unhappy man, the tears starting to his eyes at this simple question. "Nothing. Only I want it." Julie made a pretense to feel for the key. "I must have left it in my room," she said, and she went out, but instead of going to her apartment, she hastened to consult Emmanuel. "Do not give this key to your father," said he, "and tomorrow morning, if possible, do not quit him for a moment." She questioned Emmanuel, but he knew nothing or would not say it if he did. During the night between the 4th and 5th of September, Madame Morel remained listening for every sound, and until 3 o'clock in the morning she heard her husband pacing the room in great agitation. It was 3 o'clock when he threw himself on the bed. The mother and daughter passed the night together. They had expected Maximilian since the previous evening. At 8 o'clock in the morning, Morel entered their chamber. He was calm, but the agitation of the night was legible in his pale and careworn visage. They did not dare to ask him how he had slept. Morel was kinder to his wife, more affectionate to his daughter than he had ever been. He could not cease gazing at and kissing the sweet girl. Julie, mindful of Emmanuel's request, was following her father when he quitted the room, but he said to her quickly, "Remain with your mother, dearest." Julie wished to accompany him. "I wish you to do so," he said. This was the first time Morel had ever so spoken, but he said it in a tone of paternal kindness, and Julie did not dare refuse compliance. She remained at the same spot, standing mute and motionless. An instant afterwards the door opened. She felt two arms encircle her, and a mouth pressed her forehead. She looked up and uttered an exclamation of joy. "Maximilian, my dearest brother!" she cried. At these words Madame Morel rose and threw herself into her son's arms. "Mother," said the young man, looking alternately at Madame Morel and her daughter, "what has occurred? What has happened? Your letter has frightened me, and I have come hither with all speed." "Julie," said Madame Morel, making a sign to the young man, "go and tell your father that Maximilian has just arrived." The young lady rushed out of the apartment, but on the first step of the staircase she found a man holding a letter in his hand. "Are you not Mademoiselle Julie Morel?" inquired the man with a strong Italian accent. "Yes, sir," replied Julie, with hesitation. "What is your pleasure? I do not know you."
"Read this letter," he said, handing it to her. Julie hesitated. "It concerns the best interests of your father," said the messenger.
The young girl hastily took the letter from him. She opened it quickly and read, "Go this moment to the Allée de Meilhan. Enter the house number 15, ask the porter for the key of the room on the fifth floor, enter the apartment, take from the corner of the mantelpiece a purse netted in red silk, and give it to your father. It is important that he should receive it before 11 o'clock. You promised to obey me implicitly. Remember your oath. Sinbad the Sailor." The young girl uttered a joyful cry, raised her eyes, looked round to question the messenger, but he had disappeared. She cast her eyes again over the note to peruse it a second time, and saw there was a postscript. She read, "It is important that you should fulfill this mission in person and alone. If you go accompanied by any other person, or should anyone else present themselves, the porter will reply that he does not know anything about it." This postscript was a great check to the young girl's joy. Was there nothing to fear? Was there not some snare laid for her? Her innocence had kept her in ignorance of the dangers that might assail a young girl of her age. But there is no need to know danger in order to fear it. Indeed, it may be observed that it is usually unknown perils that inspire the greatest terror. Julie hesitated and resolved to take counsel. Yet by a singular feeling it was neither to her mother nor her brother that she applied, but to Emmanuel. She hastened down and told him what had occurred on the day when the agent of the house of Thompson and French had come to her father's, related the scene on the staircase, repeated the promise she had made, and showed him the letter. "You must go then, mademoiselle," said Emmanuel.
"Go there?" murmured Julie.
"Yes. I will accompany you. But did you not read that I must be alone?" said Julie. "And you shall be alone," replied the young man. "I will await you at the corner of the Rue du Musée, and if you are so long absent as to make me uneasy, I will hasten to rejoin you, and woe to him of whom you shall have cause to complain to me."
"Then, Emmanuel," said the young girl with hesitation, "is it your opinion that I should obey this invitation?"
"Yes. Did not the messenger say your father's safety was in it?"
"But what danger threatens him then, Emmanuel?" she asked.
Emmanuel hesitated a moment, but his desire to make Julie decide immediately made him reply. "Listen," he said, "today is the 5th of September, is it not?"
"Yes."
"Today, then, at 11 o'clock, your father has nearly 300,000 francs to pay."
"Yes, we know that."
"Well, then," continued Emmanuel, "we have not 15,000 francs in the house."
"What will happen then?"
"Why, if today before 11 o'clock your father has not found someone who will come to his aid, he will be compelled at 12 o'clock to declare himself a bankrupt."
"Oh, come then, come," cried she, hastening away with the young man.
During this time Madame Morel had told her son everything. The young man knew quite well that after the succession of misfortunes which had befallen his father, great changes had taken place in the style of living and housekeeping, but he did not know that matters had reached such a point. He was thunderstruck. Then, rushing hastily out of the apartment, he ran upstairs, expecting to find his father in his cabinet, but he rapped there in vain. Whilst he was yet at the door of the cabinet, he heard the bedroom door open, turned, and saw his father. Instead of going direct to his cabinet, Monsieur Morel had returned to his bedchamber, which he was only this moment quitting. Morel uttered a cry of surprise at the sight of his son, of whose arrival he was ignorant. He remained motionless on the spot, pressing with his left hand something he had concealed under his coat. Maximilian sprung down the staircase and threw his arms round his father's neck, but suddenly he recoiled and placed his hand on Morel's breast. "Father," he exclaimed, turning pale as death, "what are you going to do with the brace of pistols under your coat?"
"Oh, this is what I feared," said Morel.
"Father, father, in heaven's name," exclaimed the young man, "what are these weapons for?"
"Maximilian," replied Morel, looking fixedly at his son,